Hey, it's Maria.
And it's Julio.
So we want to share with you our show from last Wednesday. It was the live show that we recorded all the way from home. So that's what we recorded, and that's what we're going to share with you on this feed.
That's right. This has become a highlight of 2020 for me, to be able to do some of these live at-home shows with you, Maria, and our fabulous guests. So keep in mind, since we've recorded this live, so much has changed, but still, it was before the dueling town halls and before the end of the Supreme Court Amy Coney Barrett confirmation hearings. All that happened.
Well, there was more.
Yeah.
Because it was also before the weekend where there were women's marches across the country that were protesting said Supreme Court nominee, Judge Amy Coney Barrett. So a lot has happened, but still, the spirit of the show and the energy of the show and the we love you from home-ness of the show.
Yes.
Was so there.
It's there.
And it's nice to be able to do live shows from home.
I know.
Next
no traveling.
I got to bring the popcorn, though.
Yeah. So get ready to listen to this, the latest live from home in the thick. So here it is. Let's take a listen.
Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela. And welcome to In the Thick, live from home.
So, hey, thank you for joining us out there. I'm sending you a big virtual hug, but I'm really sick of virtual hugs.
Me too.
Get rid of that.
Like, I can't stand virtual hugs.
It's enough. We're really, really ready to be over this. I can't believe it, Julio. Es que no lo puedo creer that we are 20 days away from November 3rd. I mean, I just, you know.
Yeah.
People are already voting. We're going to talk about that in a second. We've got two amazing all-stars to help us make sense. This is why I love what we do, because of these people who are joining us tonight to talk about politics from a POC perspective. So first of all, from her home in Brooklyn, New York, just a stone's throw from Harlem, is Imara Jones. She's creator of Translash Media and host of the new Translash podcast, which is produced by our very own Futuro Studios. Hey, Imara.
Hi, how are you?
Hey.
Looking fabulous, Imara. Look at that background.
Thank you.
So
thank
good.
You.
And also, let's welcome Jenny Monet. She's a journalist and founder of the new weekly newsletter, Indigenously, joining us from her home in Santa Fe, New Mexico. What's up, Jenny?
Hi, Julio, Maria, Imara. Hi, great to be
here.
Hey,
good to see everybody.
Yeah, Jenny was telling us about what she had for dinner last night. We were like, you need to stop. You were having fresh tamales. Okay, it's stopped. So here's what we're going to do. One of the reasons why we love In the Thick is because we get real and we make it real for all of you and with us. So this past Monday was Indigenous Peoples Day. And as we reflect about what's going on in this country and ongoing movement for racial justice, Jenny, I was really moved by what you wrote in your Medium piece on canceling Columbus. You wrote, quote, "A lot of people think Indigenous life and death don't impact them that much. But time and again, we serve as a baseline for how society treats its most vulnerable people, notwithstanding what happens to the land." So, Jenny, political chaos, we are survivors of this. We're also witness to beautiful people power-led movements in this particular moment. But we want to do a check-in. So, you know, after 2020 Indigenous Peoples Day, reality check. How are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good. And I have to say, there was some kind of collective vibe in Indian country that somehow this year on this second day of October somehow felt different because of all of the reckoning that is happening in the country right now. And also, I think that there's just this real penetrable awakening to Indigenous visibility. I mean, for so long, the story has been that, you know, there's this story of erasure. That's Columbus Day in a nutshell, right? And what we saw last year in 2019, even before this awakening, the uprising that we're having as a country right now, what we saw last year was a record number of states who legally adopted Indigenous Peoples Day in replacement of Columbus Day. I was talking with some movement leaders, and, you know, there was just kind of a thought that a lot of the hard work of the struggle, so to speak, is now coming to the fore and really starting to see some fruits bear from a lot of that struggle.
Yeah.
Just so we're clear, that guy, who my husband will never say his name, by the way, he calls him the Admiral, El Admirante. How many days did he actually spend in North America? Zero.
Zero. The Indigenous Index is in our newsletter. We put stats of, you know, just fun factoids every week. And that was one of my favorite fun factoids.
So, Imara, et toi, Imara.
We're going through all the languages in the Americas. Yeah. Now we're on to French.
Hey, como ça va? How are you feeling? What's your temperature check?
Oh, it's okay. You know, the thing that struck me about that last conversation is that I think the thing that people need to know is that that man, I will name him. I'm going to be like, you know, the people in Harry Potter. I'm not afraid to name Lord Voldemort. I think Christopher Columbus was trash. And one of the ways... And one of the ways that you know that he was trash is that he was turned in by his own people.
Right.
They were like, no, this guy is way too murderous, rapist, everything else. Put him in chains and send him back to Spain. That's how bad he was. And so that's the guy that gets celebrated. And I think in addition to the number of days that he spent, like, there's not enough talk about literally how bad he was.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm okay. I feel like there is a lot of disturbance and turbulence coming, and I'm very much sitting in that. So that is my temperature check. And the more we get to the threshold of election day, that gets stronger. And it's not a generalized anxiety about whether he will or will not win. This other person who I'll name, Donald Trump.
I was waiting. There's another Voldemort.
But sometimes I call him the Dark Lord. I just think that we're moving into a period of mass instability, regardless of the outcome. And I'm very much sitting in that. So that's a part of my temperature, part of my where I am right now.
By the way, thank you so much, Imara, for drawing our attention to the passing of Monica Roberts, a Black trans journalist who we lost last week, the founder of TransGrio. So thank you so much. And we're so sorry about her passing.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's happened so fast and it happened too soon. I think that everyone felt that she had so much to give, and she just played a really unique role in our community. And I think that particularly as trans journalist, I think that she is the model, right? There will be, you know, buildings named after her and scholarships named after her.
Like, nice.
I very much feel and believe that that's absolutely going to happen. And, you know, she was one of the first people to say that we matter and our stories matter, and they should be treated at organizations that are supposedly about informing people and informing the news in a way that is serious. And that is pretty earth shattering. And so I think that we should all be sad, because I think that I'm sad for the people who didn't get to know her work or who didn't understand how important she was. And so I think that we should all be sad.
Presente. Julio, what's your temperature check? How you doing?
I still feel this skepticism of 2016, where, you know, you're seeing all these headlines and it's like, Biden's lead now double digits. And you're like, where have I heard this song before? Where have I heard this song before? And the only way that this is going to change is that if we can, like, you got to assume that you're going to lose. Like, you have to leave it all out on the floor. And I think that's the only difference that I'm seeing. But the traps of political media, it's just, oh, it's expanding. And you're like, I don't know, guys. Let's just wait until December 7th when it's all settled, which is, you know what I mean? Right. And not November 3rd. But what about you, Maria?
It's so interesting to see how Latinos and Latinas, considering we're the second largest voting bloc, 32 million people, it's basically like, barely a blip of a conversation. So kind of living through erasure and invisibility.
Totally. But Vanity Fair discovered us a couple of days ago, and so it's all good now. There was a piece about Vanity Fair about the Latino vote saying, Latino voters are very diverse. And I'm like,
where have you been? But talk about Columbusing. It actually came out on Indigenous People's Day,
the article.
They're like, well, they're brown.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, we discovered the Latino vote, but
I'm with Imara, though, in the sense of just kind of living through this very strange feeling of like, we don't know what's going to happen. And also, I think what's important is understanding our role. Mm-hmm. We are all producers of media, so people are looking to us. So feeling a particular weight, you know, I lost my voice this weekend, which was really weird, but it forced me into 3 days of silence, which was actually really appreciated by everyone.
I've never seen you happier.
I was like feeding my birds, doing my plants, you know, I was like, I'm trying to remain aware of the historical context.
Yeah.
Because this is some deep shit right now.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know one thing. All of us here, we are fighting for democracy. I don't know if we can say we're fighting for this democracy because I want it to be something else. I want it to be better. But I know the four of us and our entire team are fighting for this. So we ain't going anywhere. Just saying.
No, exactly. No. It's so interesting. Like a friend of mine who's native told me this in 2019. She said to me something that really resonated and I think is really powerful, which is for 500 years, they have been trying to kill us, me and my people, and we are still here, and we will be here when they leave.
100%.
Wow. I mean, we do want to talk about that, the voices, and especially in this cycle, and especially with Black and Indigenous people of color and the suppression of the vote. And just to share a stat, so far, as of today, and this is according to U.S. Elections Project that BuzzFeed reported, 14 million Americans have already voted.
Yep.
14 million.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But we're already seeing the impact of voter suppression. So if you've been following Texas, I can't even begin to fathom what the governor of Texas has ordered. One drop-off location per county.
Right.
I mean, Harris County, like, is Houston. One drop-off location.
Like, huge.
And then the other thing is, even in California, the Republicans creating like unofficial drop-off boxes, I mean, which is another bizarre thing.
But the other crazy thing is, and I wonder what the rest of the world is saying, that in the United States, you know, you have these ridiculously long lines for early voting. Mm. You also have people, again, who are not going anywhere, who are committed to the democracy and to voting. But, you know, it happens in the state of Georgia. Oh, what does Georgia have? A lot of Black voters. Voters there waited up to 12 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
¿Qué es eso? Do I want to just take a listen to one of those Georgia voters? Her name is Viola Hardy. Great name. Reporter Mark Elliott interviewed her as she stood in line. And as a former
OG
original gangster ITT, Jason Johnson said when he retweeted this video, these stories are infuriating. They're not inspiring. Here's that voter, Viola.
You know, I think people are just really ready to vote, and it doesn't matter how long it takes, we will stand in line to vote. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the most important part. We're voting like our life depends on it.
Mm. It does.
I mean, it's like real. Like, there's this inspiring thing that it's like we are voting because our life depends on it, and especially other things that are happening. I know Republicans, they're challenging everything, it seems, right? In the middle of a pandemic, it's like, well, you can't vote. You can't do this. Did you know that the RNC is spending $20 million for these election-related legal challenges that are happening? So this is, your life is literally on the line. So Imara, when you hear voices like Viola and other stories that you're seeing and all the images, how do you grapple with all this? We're seeing voter suppression right in front of us. How do you handle it?
Can I say that I think that this is just the most ham-handed approach to voter suppression I think we've seen. Voter suppression works when you don't know when it's happening. Ooh. That's when it's really impactful. That's when it was impactful in like 2016, in 1960. You know, like in these places when you don't know it's happening, that's when it's impactful. But it's really clear to people what's happening. And it's why there is a community level mobilization around this.
Right.
And I think that it's backfiring. I think that it is it is not working. So for instance, in Harris County, they had the one drop-off box. So the new county clerk, I can't remember his name. I saw him last night on Rachel Maddow. He's super cute. He's like 35. He was. I was like, oh, who's that? Because, you know, like,
hello.
Like, you know, when you're watching cable news and someone's like county clerk and you're, I grabbed the remote and then he came on, I was like, oh. I hung on every word, I can assure you. And that's why. So, and one of the things they did in Harris County is that he developed drive-in voting. Okay, so you're not allowing us to do drop-off boxes. They now have drive-in voting. Mm-hmm. So the same thing in Atlanta, where the largest arena there, where the Hawks play, the city converted it into a citywide voting place. And so it has like hundreds of machines and can accommodate thousands of people at a time.
Yeah.
I just think that it's a ham-handed approach. And I think that we know what they did in 2016. And so there is a lot of movement to shut down the voter suppression. The one area where they might be successful is everything that they're doing, you know, sub rosa, like clandestine, with Latino communities, especially on WhatsApp, like that whole WhatsApp strategy that they have for South Florida.
Yeah, no, Amara, disinformation, major issue. So take a state like Florida, for example. Latino voters, they're being flooded across their social media accounts with all these false conspiracy theories, all this misinformation about election security. And it's especially concerning because a lot of this information is happening in Spanish, like in the Spanish language.
Yeah.
And that type of information doesn't really get fact-checked as much. So there's one thing, I'm totally going to reveal this. I'm in this WhatsApp group with people in Florida who get sent these messages. And then I'm the journalist. I'm like, is this true? And I'm like, esto es una pura mentira.
But it's a lie.
This is a lie. This is a friggin' lie.
Wow. I mean, that's the whole problem of what we've been living through for the last 4 years is we have been saying, but this is a lie.
Right.
But these are not the rules. But, you know, people are like, yeah, but he's a white guy, so we have to trust him.
Mm. That shit is crazy, by the
way. But we're living through it, which is, again, why all of us have a responsibility to do something about this, right? So listen, the voter suppression tactics. By the way, I really appreciate what you say, Amara.
Yeah.
I love this image of hams as hands. So it's really
and it's really appropriate thinking about Trump, right? Yeah. Trump with ham hands is like perfect.
My God, I'm loving the fact that I'm laughing so much because really I should be crying right now. All right. Mm. So Jenny, look, in terms of indigenous people, many who live on the reservations don't, we know this, right? They don't have formal addresses. It's really hard. You live really far away from a post office. In your latest Indigenously newsletter, Jenny, you wrote about an important legal case in Arizona that could make or break November's election in the swing state of Arizona. And that's the case where Navajo Nation members are asking to extend the deadline of absentee ballots for the reasons I just mentioned, right? They're far, et cetera. Not to mention that Navajo Nation has been hard hit by COVID. So, Jenny, give us a sense of what, if Amara says it's ham-handed in the rest of the country, is it ham-handed on indigenous land, or is it much more secretive, or is it just invisible?
Mm. Oh my gosh, no. Native people know that the struggle to vote is very much a present situation that has not been fixed or corrected. I mean, the last state in the country is believed to have been in Maine in 1968 before natives could even vote in state elections. So, I mean, that's not that long ago.
Wow, Jenny. And actually, I'm getting notifications from our amazing team of producers at In the Thick. And what you just said actually confirms a lot of how voting rights for indigenous people haven't been clear cut. Mm-hmm. Take, for example, the Snyder Act of 1924, which granted full citizenship to indigenous people born within the U.S., but it still left it up to states to determine voting rights. So, hello, Maine. Mm-hmm. There you go. So it took some four decades for all states to grant voting rights to indigenous people. And even so, sometimes this was just a right, quote, on paper. In reality, there were still clear efforts to suppress and prevent indigenous communities from voting.
Right. And so what you're seeing, I think just in general around mail-in ballots is extreme when it comes to Indian country. I think in this election, mail-in ballots are such a critical part of the suppression across all peoples, all citizens in America because of the coronavirus, because so few people are going to go to the polls this election year and they're going to choose to mail in their votes. And that's where the attacks are kind of happening. And so in Indian country, that's always kind of been the situation. Like in Montana, for instance, they have for years had a a ballot collection system where across reservations, people could go door to door and pick up people's absentee ballots and deliver them into the precinct. And this year, that was under attack in a lawsuit that actually got resolved in favor of the ballot collection. But then also what you have in Arizona is, you know, extreme, because we know that the Navajo Nation got hit so hard with the coronavirus. We know that the reservation is, you know, when all combined, is about the size of West Virginia. And literally, when you start looking at where post offices are on the reservation, it's like what you were discussing in Texas about precincts. I mean, like, if we take that Virginia analogy, there are hundreds compared to just a few dozen on the reservation to service the same kind of span of geography. And so it just doesn't even make sense to some communities.
I just want to quote The Guardian about that Arizona lawsuit. And it's Yazzie versus Hobbs, right? It pointed out that the reservation's 27,425 square miles are covered by just 24 post offices and 15 postal service providers. The slightly smaller state of West Virginia has roughly 10 times the population, but it's covered by 725 post offices and postal service provider sites. And that's via The Guardian. So
we're clear. It's 24 versus 725. Okay, just so we're clear. They have 700 more.
And so this year, that seems to be the voter suppression. But I mean, all one has to do is really look at this race in San Juan County, Utah, to understand how the gerrymandering gets manipulated for like over 100 years. It's a small, tiny little county commission that was kind of making up the rules as they go along to maintain white power structure in the region.
Right.
And it wasn't until recently that got overturned by Navajos winning a little known two seats on a three-seat county commission. And I think that's a big point for people to understand, is that for Indian country, yes, we have big races where we have, you know, now four members in Congress, and the last two being Deb Haaland and Sharice Davids. And those are huge, huge gains for us.
Right.
But in Indian country, it's these tiny little known races that also are incredibly impactful. One race is happening in South Dakota, a public utilities commission race with Remy Bald Eagle.
When I was young, the Cheyenne River was polluted with the tailings off of the Homestake gold mine. It was the lifeline of this community. And water, it's not a source of life. It is the source of life. Everything revolves around water. That's why Cherry Creek is the oldest community in South Dakota. After it was polluted, we lost a lot. We lost so much. And the communities are still suffering. It's the responsibility of those in charge in the Public Utilities Commission to ensure that this doesn't happen to another community.
And one would think that a Public Utilities Commission isn't a big deal, but when you start to look at oil and gas projects that are going on in near tribal lands, it becomes vital.
Listen, we want to move to some more political theater. This week in political theater, the confirmation hearing of Amy Coney Barrett, who is, you know, will very likely be confirmed to fill Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She scares me because she is this very smart, intelligent person who is going to just implement policies that opposes everything about POC, women, LGBTQ community. She is an originalist, which also makes me shudder, because this constitution, it's all of a sudden like the constitution is the perfect document where it's like, let's go back to 1789 where white landed, you know, rich men only had a voice. I was very struck by the whiteness of the conversation. And even when there was a moment where Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, during the hearing, like, talked about trolling moments.
Some butthead professor at Boston University says that because you and your husband have two children of color, that you're a white colonist. The implication is that you're a racist, and that you use your two children as props. Do you use your children as props?
Senator Kenny, it was the risk of people saying things like that, which would be so hurtful to my family, that when I told Senator Graham this morning that my husband and I had to really weigh the costs of this, it was saying deeply offensive and hurtful things, things that are not only hurtful to me, but are hurtful to my children, who are my children, who we love, and who we brought home and made part of our family. And accusations like that are cruel.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? How low can you go? I didn't want to ask that question when your kids were here. I'm sorry I have to go through that. Okay, let's talk about the law.
Okay, that was the butthead professor he was talking about. Mm-hmm. Was Ibram Kendi. So, you know, I mean, come on. But listen, Jenny, I was really struck by that. And I wanted you to weigh in because I was like, I need to ask Jenny this question. I told the producers because it was like, well, you're not a white colonizer. You have adopted Haitian children. Jenny, I'm tossing it to you because I think Senator Kennedy's lack of history is so obvious here. What do you think?
Well, it was so incredibly staged, too. Mm. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just dripping with all kinds of, I mean, all the rhetoric that they want us to talk about. But I mean, is it out of the way to say that, you know, ethnic children in a white privileged family by a woman who's trying to dismantle, say, reproductive rights? I mean, it's, let's put it into context in all of its form. And I don't see how that was even part of the conversation in these confirmation hearings. I didn't understand why that was even allowed, to be quite honest. I mean, we're allowed in our spaces to have these opinions, and the opinions, to be quite honest, in this time, you know, they're quite appropriate. And so I just was dismayed to see that had even made it into the hearings.
Yeah.
Right. I'm still dismayed. I'm just dismayed that this has all happened.
I'm dismayed at that pink bus.
Yes. I just don't understand, again, how it is that the Democrats are not prepared for these kind of fast moves. Okay. Mm. Anyway, look, as Julio mentioned, what we have been seeing with the hearings is they're, how white the politics are, right? And how we are excluded. But you can also see how these institutions, again, in front of our very own eyes, are defending Christian rights over human rights. So there was a moment in the hearing where LGBTQ rights were addressed in regards to marriage equality, which we know Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito recently issued a statement calling out the 2015 court decision for prioritizing the constitutional rights of LGBTQ people. Basically, they were saying that giving equal rights for same-sex marriage would then end up labeling those with religious beliefs against it as bigots. Okay. All right.
Go on.
So during the hearing, Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono called out Amy Coney Barrett for saying sexual preference. Mm. Listen to this.
This morning, Senator Feinstein asked you a question about the Supreme Court's 2015 decision in Obergefell v. Hodges, a case in which the court recognized the constitutional right to same-sex marriage. And I was disappointed that you wouldn't give a direct answer on whether you agreed with the majority in that case, or if you instead agree with your mentor, Justice Scalia, that no such right exists in the Constitution. So even though you didn't give a direct answer, I think your response did speak volumes. Not once, but twice. You used the term sexual preference to describe those in the LGBTQ community. And let me make clear, sexual preference is an offensive and outdated term. It is used by anti-LGBTQ activists to suggest that sexual orientation is a choice. It is not. Sexual orientation is a key part of a person's identity, that sexual orientation is both a normal expression of human sexuality and immutable, was a key part of the majority's opinion in Obergefell, which, by the way, Scalia did not agree with.
So, Imara, you dig deep into, in this week's Translash podcast, about, you know, the religious right. Mm. We should be thinking about their way of seeing the world in terms of punishment around being LGBTQ. Mm. So we're really facing like a serious conservative backlash. I mean, I still can't fathom that she's going to be confirmed. I'm just like, there's got to be.
It's going to happen. It's nothing.
Maria, I can't even stand it when you say that it's going to happen because I'm like.
It's a given.
It's like, no.
Just let it go. It's a given.
So if I'm freaking out and I'm not part of the LGBTQ community, Imara, tell us.
First of all, I just also wanted to say that Ibrahim, who made those comments, he's cute as well, by the way. So that's
he yes. is. I've seen him around okay, Boston.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so yeah,
Ibrahim X Kendi. Yes, he's the author of the book How to Be an Anti-Racist and Stand.
So keep talking. Keep saying controversial things so we can keep seeing you. So that's the first thing. The second thing is on a more serious note. I think that we should. You know, just underscore that she didn't come out of nowhere. She is 48, and it's ironic because she is also the culmination of a 50-year strategy by the right to elevate a person exactly like her on the court to be the swing vote to roll back an array of rights. So she's not an accident. And so then when she was giving us that sing song about how she and her husband thought twice about whether or not they were going, she didn't think twice about anything. She's been cultivated by the Federalist Society, by the right wing, by Scalia for this moment. There is no way for a second that she wasn't going to take this. And so that rang false to me. I also want to underscore as well, there is a way in which her motherhood and her humility and her pink suits and all of this, like, you know, like Dolores Umbridge. I keep doing Harry Potter tonight. Like Dolores Umbridge from Harry Potter, who was like, she was a sadist, but she would wear pink.
Progress for the sake of progress must be discouraged. Let us preserve what must be preserved, perfect what can be perfected, and prune practices that ought to be prohibited.
Oh my, wait a minute.
Right.
You just put two and two together for me because I've been trying to figure out Amy Coney Barrett.
Yeah.
I've never seen any Harry Potter movies.
Oh, Imara, thank you.
I don't know what you all are talking about.
I'm off too, Maria. It's okay.
Okay, I'm sorry. Harry Potter talk on In the Thick. Thank you, Imara.
But we love you, Imara, so go.
Thank you. So the whole thing is that is being very much cultivated. Mm. But we all know the reality is different. We all know that there were thousands of Native kids that were forced into adoption off of reservation as a way of cultural cleansing who were adopted by racist white people. There's nothing about having or adopting people of color that absolves you of racism. I'm not saying that she's a racist, but I'm saying that they're being used as a prop as well in this moment. Mm-hmm. And so like, that doesn't give you a pass. And I would also encourage people to go back and listen to the way that she described her children. So she describes how smart her children are. But then when she comes to her black child, she talks about how she can dead weight lift more than any other man.
Jesse and I are parents to seven wonderful children. Our oldest daughter, Emma, is a sophomore in college who just might follow her parents into a career in the law. Next is Vivian, who came to us from Haiti. When Vivian arrived, she was so weak that we were told she might never talk or walk normally. But now she deadlifts as much as the male athletes in our gym, and I assure you she has no trouble talking. Tess is 16, and while she shares her parents' love for the liberal arts, she also has a math gene that seems to have skipped her parents' generation. John Peter joined us shortly after the devastating earthquake in Haiti. And Jesse, who brought him home, still describes the shock on JP's face when he got off the plane in wintertime Chicago. Once that shock wore off, JP assumed the happy-go-lucky attitude that is still his signature trait. Liam is smart, strong, and kind, and to our delight, he still loves watching movies with mom and dad. 10-year-old Juliet is already pursuing her goal of becoming an author, by writing multiple essays and short stories, one of which she recently submitted for publication. And our youngest, Benjamin, is at home with friends. Benjamin has Down syndrome, and he is the unanimous favorite of the family.
Right, so even the way that she talks about her children raises that. On this figure of like religiosity and the way in which it ties into anti-LGBTQ rights. One of the things that the person that I spoke to, who is a member of the religious right, Debbie Jackson, until her child Avery revealed in their toddler years that she was trans, which then sent Debbie on this journey into coming out of her Southern Baptist Alabama upbringing, she makes a really good point about these. And I think that we even saw it with Amy Coney Barrett. She says, you know, and people are going to get upset, but I'm sorry, this is life. It's harsh. Get with it. That, you know, a lot of the women through the course of the religion and upbringing are literally brainwashed to believe that they are just vessels for the men. And you will see, if you go back and you listen to Amy Coney Barrett's conversation, there's never a conversation about herself. It is always herself as a mom. It is never about herself as a woman that's not tied either to her religion when she talks personally or her children. She's very much, again, a product of this particular moment and these people. And we do have to understand these religious movements. And, you know, in so many ways, she is the fulfillment of this weird nexus that they have between religion and oppression. And of course, in that there's not space for a lot of people. And I was also, one other thing I was really struck by for her is how, you know, she was like, I can't answer that because the case may come before whatever. Okay. It's such a vapid answer because honestly, this is the only moment in which you are accountable to the people for a lifelong appointment. You actually do owe us answers, right? You don't get to sit there and just say, well, right, I can't answer because one day that might come before my court.
Because you're absolutely right, Amara. It is sort of this manufactured plan, like,
oh, highly,
right? So when you see a highly intelligent woman, and like, I'll give you another example of this that scared the crap out of me, and I want to get your thoughts, Jenny, is when Senator Cory Booker, who asked Coney Barrett about election integrity.
Do you believe that every president should make a commitment unequivocally and resolutely to the peaceful transfer of power?
Well, Senator, that seems to me to be pulling me in a little bit into this question of whether the president has said that he would not peacefully leave office. And so to the extent that this is a political controversy right now, as a judge, I want to stay out of it, and I don't want to express a view on...
So, Judge, I appreciate what you've said about respecting our founding fathers, about the originalism. It's remarkable that we're at a place right now that... this is becoming a question and a topic, but I'm asking you, in light of our founding fathers, in light of our traditions, in light that everyone who serves in that office has sworn an oath where they, quote, swear to preserve and protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, I'm just asking you, should a president commit themselves, like our founding fathers, I think, have a clear intention, like the grace that George Washington showed, the peaceful transfer of power, is that something that presidents should be able to do?
Well, one of the beauties of America from the beginning of the Republic is that we have had peaceful transfers of power, and that disappointed voters have accepted the new leaders that come into office. And that's not true in every country. And I think it is part of the genius of our Constitution and the good faith and goodwill of the American people that we haven't had the situations that have arisen in so many other countries where there have been, where those issues have been present.
Okay.
Answer the question.
Well, we better just get ready.
Yeah.
So she's not going to answer the question.
Jenny, but I want to share this one stat. This is from new polling from Data for Progress and the Justice Collaborative Institute, and says the majority of Republican voters, 77% say they would trust Trump if he calls the election one way or another. So think about that, wow, Jenny. So this notion of peaceful transfer of power, Trump has, I mean, talk about power.
I mean, talk about believing Trump. There was like this huge divide of whether or not people believed whether or not he really had coronavirus. I mean, we can't, right? There's this notion of like, we can't trust anything that this man says. I think the one thing that we can trust is our instincts and bracing ourselves for an incredible post-election. They're already talking about the election as in terms of a week, because the mail-in ballots, again, as I mentioned, are so high. An unprecedented number of people are voting by mail. In many states, it's not aligned. So in many states, they don't start getting counted until after Election Day. There's apparently like Republicans are going to, you know, flood the polls so that on election night, those numbers look and bring the appearance of a Trump victory on election night, whereas the notion is that a bunch of Democrat votes are going to be trickling in through mail-in ballots over the course of a week, if not more. And I just think that it's going to be an incredibly tense time. I think everyone should be aware of that.
It's bad.
I've been thinking about how I'm going to self-care for myself in that time span, because it's going to be, I just predict that it's going to be crazy. It's going to be wild. Misinformation is going to be flying all over the place. I just think we should all be very clear-eyed about what's ahead of us.
Thank you to our In the Thick audience watching from their home and watching our homes. And I want to say thank you to our ITT All-Stars, Imara Jones, creator of Translash Media. Thank you for creating Translash Media.
Yes.
Thank you for creating the Translash podcast. We love you, Imara. And awesome. Jenny Monet, journalist and founder of the new weekly newsletter, Indigenously. Thank you for doing that. I know it's all very scary, but we are creating the narratives. We are taking control. So thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this live episode of In the Thick.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you all so much.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela. If you can't get enough of this, because it was fabulous, we're going to be live from home again on election night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard, until midnight, 6 hours of In the Thick with a bunch of ITT All-Star guests. They're going to talk about the election, about what's going on. They're going to bring popcorn. So join us here while you're watching your cable news and be like, you know what? I'm bored. What's Maria saying?
Something smart.
It'll be fun. You can follow us on social media, In the Thick Show, In the Thick Podcast.
So remember, dear listener, you can go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us, because it really does help. Rate and review, rate and review. Also, you can listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook. Tell your familia and friends to listen. Extra shout out to our ITT production team, who made these live virtual shows a reality. Thank you so much. Tonight's show was produced by the fabulous Nicole Rothwell. And In the Thick is also produced by Noor Saudi and our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow, Harsha Nahata, with editorial support from Erica Dilday. Gracias to our digital editor, Luis Luna, for making all the beautiful graphics. Our rock star intern is Sophie Davis. Thank you to our audio engineers who make this all sound good from home. Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, Leah Shaw, Alicia Shiba Itup, and Gabriela Baez. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me.
And also a big special thanks to Now This. We were on Now This today, so thank you to Now This.
And the music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Captain ZZK Records. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Goodbye.
Ciao. Nos vemos. Bye. Adios.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.